Okay, good evening. If you would, please open your Bibles and turn with me to Genesis chapter 38. Genesis 38. We're going to be starting there in just a minute. Genesis chapter 38. So here we are in our study. We're drawing near to some of the final scenes here in Genesis. As we wrap up this study, we're going to look through chapter 38, and then we're going to go to chapter 46 through 48 tonight, and that's what we're going to cover. And I'll talk a little bit about why that particular order. But first, before we get started, I've asked Michael, if he would, to lead us in a word of prayer to kind of focus our thoughts now on the study. Amen. Thank you. Okay, so we've been studying about Joseph, and we did the first discussion, chapter 37, and then chapters 39 to 41. We talked about Joseph the dreamer, and we talked about his dreams. We talked about Joseph the ruler. Tonight we're going to look at a story that comes right in the middle of that, in chapter 38, about Judah and Tamar. And, you know, you might scratch your head a little bit and say, okay, why is this story here? It's not a very nice story. Not a very pleasant story. And if you'll forgive me, I'm not going to go into great detail on the specific sins that are mentioned here. You can read about them yourself. But we're going to talk about them a little bit. We're going to talk about the situation that's going on in the sons of Israel at this time. And I think this story is placed here for a reason. So in some ways, I kind of regret now pulling it out of sequence, but we're going to go into this story. And if you notice where this is placed, it's placed just after Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers, and before we start to see the story of how he acts when he comes to Potiphar's house, all right? And so in some ways, this story provides a little break. It's kind of like if you're watching a TV show and you cut away from the main scene and go see something else and then you come back. In some ways, this story provides a break away from Joseph, and some years pass, and then we see him later down in Egypt. In some ways, this story tells us about the situation of the sons of Israel. Their integration into the nations around them, as they should not have done, and the way they had really adopted the sins of the people around them. We see that in this story. So, in some ways, it might even tell us a little bit of why God needed to send them to Egypt, why they needed to go there to become a nation, to become a people. So, as we look at this story, Judah and Tamar, just after Joseph is sold into slavery, it says Judah departed from his brothers. I don't know if he was fed up with them. You know, I don't know if he saw that the relationship was not good, but it says he left them and went and lived among the Canaanites. Had a friend by the name of Hirah, an Adullamite, married a Canaanite woman, and he had three sons. And Judah chose a name for his first son. And Judah chose a wife for his first son. But the Bible tells us this first son was exceedingly evil, and he died. According to the law and the custom at that time, now this is not Mosaic law, although it later got codified into the Mosaic law, if the first son is married and dies without a son, then the brother is to marry the woman, and the first son is to continue his lineage, and then the later children will be his. So the first son died without a son, without a child. So the second son's place is to marry her and raise up a child that the name of his brother will continue. He refused to do it. And because he refused to do it, it says he died as well. So now we've got this woman who has lost two husbands. Judah has a third son, and according to custom, she should marry that son. That's how it should happen. But Judah is very non-committal about this. And he says, you go stay in your father's house, and we'll see what happens. If you notice very carefully what it says here in chapter 38, Judah said, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. He didn't say he was going to marry them. He just said, wait until he's grown. And almost then to himself he adds, for he said, lest he also die like his brothers. Now, I don't know if he thought that somehow Tamar was killing off her husbands, or if it was just bad luck, if Judah had succumbed to superstition. But for whatever reason, he's very non-committal about doing what he's supposed to do, which is to give this woman in marriage to the third son. All right. So Tamar takes an action. She decides, for whatever reason, that she's going to have a son. And so she puts a veil around her face, which would be traditional for a harlot, sits alongside the road. Judah comes by, strikes a bargain with her. And as part of this bargain, he's going to pay a price, but she asks for a pledge that she actually will get that price, because, you know, he's not carrying cash in his pocket or anything. He's going to provide a goat. So she asks for a pledge, and he says, well, okay. So she asks for his signet ring, his cord, and his staff, three pieces of identification which would clearly identify who the man was. And, you know, apparently she would hold on to those, he would send the promised payment and get the pledge back, and life would go on. It's not clear to me if this was something that Judah had been known to do. Maybe this was a habit with him. How did Tamar know that this plan, this crazy plan, might work? Don't know. But this is the plan she engages in. And sure enough, she sits alongside the road. She doesn't sit there very long, because later, you know, after passion has subsided and Judah's going to pay his debt, he sends his friend, the Adullamite, with the promised payment. He can't find the woman. And furthermore, none of the people of the town know who she is. She hadn't been sitting there very long, not long enough for anybody to even recognize her. She's just gone. And, okay, so he assumed it was maybe a temple prostitute, so this would have been part of the cult worship at the time. I say, it's a crazy plan. But it worked, and Tamar got pregnant. And so then, 3 months later, the men come rushing into Judah with the news that your daughter-in-law has gotten pregnant. And she brings out the signet and the cord and the staff and said, the man who belongs to these, he's the one. Ugly, ugly story. Why would Tamar do that? Don't know. Is she looking for that offspring that she didn't get from her first two husbands? Looking to maintain the name, the lineage? When this is all done, Judah says, she's more righteous than I. And he sends her off, and she lives in widowhood after that. But she has babies. She has two babies, twins. And these babies are in the lineage of Christ. This story is relevant. They're in the lineage of David. They're in the lineage of Christ. Why tell us this story? What do you think? How distinct were the sons of Israel from the nations around them at this time? Were they a separate people? Were they keeping themselves apart? Doesn't appear to be. Now, at this point, they hadn't been called out of Egypt yet. They hadn't had the Mosaic Law. They didn't have Levites and priests and all these things. But these are Abraham's grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So, they're not very distinct. Are these men going to form a nation? Men like this? What do you think? Seems unlikely. And when we then come into the chapters we looked at on Sunday, when Joseph said that God is providing, making a provision for the posterity, this might be part of that provision, is he's got some work to do on how they view themselves relative to the nations around them. Because at this point, I mean, they're engaged in everything. The sexual immorality, idolatry, everything that you see going on around them is happening. Right? In this story, which of the two were innocent? I wouldn't say either one were. It's just, as I said, it's just kind of an ugly little story. But what was Judah's sin? The obvious sin, going into a harlot, was the other sin. Didn't give his son. Yeah, didn't keep his word. Didn't do what he was supposed to do, at least by custom. And he had given his word, but maybe it was a weasel word. You know, he didn't actually say he was going to give her to his son, but he certainly implied it. Yeah, let's burn her. Yeah, he's ready to carry out the law. And by the way, the law for adultery was not burning, it was stoning. So, you know, the burning, at least the custom would have been, this would be a little more severe than what was required. She had to die. Judah was responsible for her now as the father-in-law, apparently. So he's the one called on to make a judgment. And what he concludes is, well, she's more righteous than I am. Normally she would have, yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. That's a good point. What about Tamar? I mean, she's guilty of sexual immorality, of course. Anything else that you can see in her behavior? I don't think we're meant to understand that relative morality is the issue here. But I think one of the things that this passage does show us is a little bit what's going on, you know, among the people at this time. And you know, they were very much like the nations around them. What was Judah's relationship with the Canaanite Hira, the Adullamite? Remember? They're friends, yeah. Judah went to visit him, was going to stay with him, apparently was there for some time. After engaging with this woman that he thought was a harlot, he asked his friend to take the payment. So, you know, this is someone who's at least close enough to do these sort of supporting activities, or maybe he thought Hira just wouldn't be bothered by the immorality of the whole thing. Don't know. Okay, so Judah's got a relationship with someone who's probably not helping him morally. Tamar's defense and Judah's response. Was Tamar's defense reasonable? Did she have a defense? Did she deny the charge, which was playing the harlot or sexual immorality? She didn't deny it. She couldn't deny that she was pregnant. Her only defense was, this was the man who did this. And Judah's response, of course, was that she's more righteous than I. Did Judah learn something from this? You know, we have to wonder. We have to wonder. Judah is the one, if you remember, in the previous chapter, Judah's the one who said, hey, let's not murder Joseph, let's just sell him to the slavers. And in the next chapters, Judah is the one who stands up for Benjamin and puts himself in Benjamin's place and says, hey, keep me here and let the boy go. Stands before his father and says, if I don't bring Benjamin back, I'll bear the guilt before you forever. So Judah has changed, at least, in the period of time from chapter 37 to chapter 39, right? What's that? Deception can come back on you, yeah? Yeah? That, yeah. Any other thoughts, any other comments on this chapter? Who is Judah? Who is Judah, right? And that's an important point. This story of Judah, Judah is the tribe from which kings will come. Judah is the tribe which remains faithful to the son of Solomon when the other tribes left. Judah is the tribe to which all the Levites came after the separation of the nation. Judah is the tribe that had good kings and bad kings. The Israel had all bad kings. Judah is the tribe that went into captivity and in which the remnant eventually came back. And Judah is the tribe from which Jesus is descended. So it's an important story. It's an important story. What it tells us that Judah evolved, he grew, he learned from his mistakes, maybe. We see a different Judah in chapter 39 than we saw in chapter 37, I think. Right? And in the next lesson, when we talk about the blessings, we'll see that Jacob, in his blessing to Judah, clearly recognizes that there are some differences in Judah's future from those of his brothers. Okay. How did this prepare Judah for his later events? What do you think? Humbled him. Had to humble him. She is more righteous than I am. Minutes earlier it was burner. Now she's more humble than I am. Sends her off into widowhood. Never had relationships with her again. But he recognized at least something in terms of his own behavior. So, Israel's journey to Egypt. Starting now here in chapter 46, where we left off in the story is Joseph, under orders from Pharaoh, has sent carts with his brothers to collect Jacob and all his things and travel to land of Egypt. And of course, Pharaoh very magnanimously says, settle in the best part of the land. Don't worry about your stuff. Just come down here. The best of Egypt is all before you. So the Israelites packed up two changes of clothes, left everything where it lay, and headed for Egypt. I didn't say that. They took all their possessions, all their cattle, their flocks. Why is that? Why didn't they do what Pharaoh said? Don't know. Maybe they were afraid that this was the magnanimity of a king in front of his subject that might not actually pan out. Maybe they considered all of the things that they had to truly be blessings from God and not to be spurned. Maybe they were just afraid that they wouldn't have their stuff when they got there, and so whatever reason, they packed everything up on the wagons and they left from where? Hebron. They were in Hebron. Left from Hebron, traveled to Beersheba, and they stopped. They stopped at Beersheba so Jacob could sacrifice. Now, it says when they left immediately. Apparently, they heeded Pharaoh's warning, come immediately. They left immediately, but then they stopped to sacrifice. Why? Why do you think Jacob stopped? Going to give glory to God. Okay, giving glory to God for Joseph even, maybe? Don't know. Why else might Jacob stop? Okay. Earlier, yeah, nobody knows what's going on down in that place. Well, yeah, and up to this point, they're living in the promised land. They're living the dream. Don't have any food, but they're living in the promised land. And God hadn't told them to leave. Pharaoh told them to leave, but God hadn't told them to leave, right? So I think it's significant in what God tells him is don't be afraid to go. He's now giving him permission, or maybe giving him a command. But if we look at what happens, he stops and he sacrifices, which is a natural thing for Jacob. And then at night, God appears to him in a dream or in a vision. And here's the sort of the five things he says. First of all, I am God, the God of your father. Was there some confusion about that? Or is he just reinforcing the same Elohim, Yahweh, who has been with your father and your grandfather, I am also with you. I am God, the God of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I will make of you a great nation there. They're not a great nation yet, right? I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you and will surely bring you up. So there's a promise there of a return to the promised land. And the last piece, which would be a comfort, is Joseph will put his hands on your eyes. What does that mean? Put his hand on your eyes. When he dies, Joseph will be with him. The comfort, he'll be reunited with his son, and he'll be with his son when his days are done, right? So this is the comfort that God gives to Jacob. Is it a message of comfort, do you think? It should be, right? Should be. Is the message just to Jacob? It's to all of them. It's to the nation. The promise of, I will surely bring you up, Jacob's not coming back. Jacob will die in Egypt. His bones will be carried back. That's right. They all wanted to be buried back in the promised land. Why is that? Why do they want to be buried there? They're just trying to cause trouble for the family? What do you think? Why did they want to be buried in the promised land? because it's the promised land, right? Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. And starting, let's see, where is it? Verse 21. By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of his sons of Joseph and worshiped leaning on top of his staff. By faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. Jacob made Joseph swear an oath, as we'll see here in a little bit. And Hebrews says that for Joseph, when he gave the same command, it was by faith. So this promise, this need to have their mortal remains put back in the promised land, we learn is by faith. Okay, what might that mean? Why by faith? What's the faith in having your body brought back after you've left it? Okay. Buried in the land of their possession? Well, that, yeah, yeah. How much of that land did they own at this time? Just enough to bury in, right? Yeah, I think that's really it. This is faith in the fact that God was going to fulfill the promise of the promised land that they'd been dwelling in as pilgrims and sojourners. But by faith, they want to be buried there because that's where all their family's going to be. So it is faith, yeah. Yep. Well, yeah, his bones will be brought up. But also, I think this is, we see this now as a promise to his descendants. As they get down to Egypt, and of course things are great while the Pharaoh's alive, and then the Pharaoh dies, another Pharaoh rises up, and then another, another, and eventually things are not going to be great in Egypt, right? It's going to get really bad for the Israelites. This promise would sustain them. Out of Egypt he called his son. Okay? Good. All right, so God makes this promise to Jacob here in Beersheba. And then with his whole household, 70 people, his sons, his grandsons, or sons, his son's sons, his daughters, and his son's daughters. I'm not sure about his daughter's sons. No, basically his whole household, right? His whole household. And they counted up as 70 people. If you spend some time in this chapter trying to make it all add up to 70, you might struggle with it a little bit, because sometimes they count the wives and sometimes they don't. But basically it's a fairly small crowd, 70 people. 70 people, and that's the whole household, everything. That's it. They're done with the promised land. They've emigrated to Canada or whatever it is. You know, they're leaving the promised land. They're going to Egypt temporarily, right? All right. So they get down there. They arrive in Goshen. Judah goes on ahead to meet up with Joseph, find out where they're supposed to go. Apparently, there was some available land in Goshen, probably, but they'd need to find exactly the right place, whatever that was going to be. And Joseph then gets ready. When they come up there, he gets his chariot ready. He goes and he falls on his father's neck and he weeps for a long time. And, of course, Israel says, "Now let me die. I've seen the face of my son." And he's very happy. Now, is Israel going to die? He's old. He's 130 years old here. We'll find out here in a few minutes. But now it's time to go meet Pharaoh. Because we've come to Egypt, and Pharaoh knows the whole family's come. Pharaoh said, okay, you know, they're here. It's time to present them to Egypt. So Joseph gives him some careful instruction. When you go, say that we're shepherds. Shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians. So why do we want to say they're shepherds? Won't integrate. Yeah, exactly that. That's funny. Yeah, it says here that the shepherds are an abomination to Egypt. So Joseph's got to walk kind of a fine line here. You know, first of all, he doesn't want to irritate Pharaoh by bringing in people that, you know, that he can't get close to. On the other hand, in some ways, he wants them up in Goshen. If you look where Goshen is, if you look where Goshen is on the map here, look where Goshen is. That's where all the water is, right? If you're in a famine, you want to be where the water is. And if you got herds and livestock and everything, you need to be where there's water. That's the most likely place for grazing land to still remain. So he settles them up here in Goshen, and that's where he wants them to be. So he tells Pharaoh, or tells his brothers, when you go to Pharaoh, tell him you're shepherds. And so they do, and we'll come to that here in a few minutes. But let's look at a few questions. Why was it important for Jacob to stop in Beersheba and sacrifice? I think we touched on that a little bit. Why was that important? What's that? Faith in God. Yeah. Needed to make sure that this was really part of God's plan. Because God hadn't told him to go to Egypt yet. Right? Bigger question. Why was it necessary for Israel to move to Egypt? Now think a little bigger. Think beyond just the famine. Okay, we talked about the famine. They stay in Canaan, they're going to starve. But with everything we've learned about Egypt, why do you think God would say, you know what, it's time for them to go spend some time at the mouth of the Nile? What do you think? Okay, oppression would help to solidify them. But even before that, remember the Egyptians would see a shepherd as an abomination. So even though they were in Egypt, there was no danger of them intermingling with the Egyptians. The Egyptians wanted nothing to do with them, right? So they were very separate people in the midst of this Egyptian culture where there was going to be no temptation for intermarriage. Okay. Okay. How many people came back? 70 people went down. How many people came back? Cherry's point about room to spread out. Anybody know? Close to a million. If you go to Numbers chapter 1 and verse 46, we see them coming out of the land of Egypt. And when they come out of the land of Egypt, they have 603,000 fighting men. 603,000 fighting men. So what's the multiplier you want to use times fighting men to account for the women and the children? Definitely going to be somewhere over a million, even if it's just 1-to-1, but you got to count the kids too. Maybe 1.5 million. 70 over a million. 70 over a million. 70 over a million. A lot of growth, a lot of spreading out here. And Egypt was a place where they did it, right? Why else? Any other reasons why God would have needed for Israel to go to Egypt? Because obviously it's God's providence at work here. He had a reason to want them to go. Why else might he want them to go? Remember what was going on with Judah in chapter 38? Sexual immorality with the people around him, idolatry. Now they're in Egypt where the Egyptians won't even touch them, right? They're an abomination. They're not even going to get close to them. So, in a way, they're a little bit insulated from the sort of intermingling that the Canaanites would like to have done with the Jews, right? If the Egyptians hadn't been so hands-off, Israel would have been swallowed up and you'd never hear from them again, because the Egyptian population was substantially larger than 70 people. To grow unified. Yeah, and right. And as Jason pointed out, this persecution is going to draw them together. And God said he would go down there with them. They would retain the knowledge of God while they were down there. And when the persecution started, it's going to draw them together, right? So how do we see the providence of God foretold in this message to Jacob? Well, I think we see it in bringing them down to Egypt. They needed to go down there to develop into the nation that they needed to be. And God was going to protect them. God was going to bring them back. When the persecution started, they could hang on to this message that I will bring you back up. Right? The promised land is still in their promise. Okay. All right. So then we go before Pharaoh, and the five brothers go just as Joseph has carefully instructed them. And among the questions that Pharaoh asks, one of the questions is, what do you do? Well, we're shepherds, and our fathers have been shepherds, and this is what we do. And Joseph has already settled them in Goshen, where it's fairly open. They're already there. It's away from the Egyptians. They don't have to smell the sheep. They don't have to see these people. So Joseph has already set up a perfect situation. All he really needs is just for Pharaoh to bless it, right? So he sends the five brothers in, and Pharaoh asks them, they tell him, not only does he say, yes, settle them in Goshen, and oh, by the way, if any of them are particularly capable, why don't you have them care for my flocks as well? So all in all, a very equitable situation with Pharaoh, right? Okay. So then Jacob presents his father. Not unnormal. Why does Pharaoh want to see an abominable shepherd from Canaan? The father of his right-hand man. That's right. That's right. So at least for some reason, Pharaoh wants to meet him. And so Joseph presents him. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. What do you take from that? Jacob blessed Pharaoh. First of all, why did he do that? Right. Because we read in Hebrews that it's always the greater blessing the lesser. So here we see this Canaanite shepherd blessing the ruler of Egypt. Blessed him twice. Once when he came in, once when he came out. Maybe this was just typical of an aged man of God. You know, someone who had been following God. God had appeared to him how many times? Right? And so he blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh asked his age. That's always a risky question to ask someone their age. Katie, you're laughing. but he asked him his age. He must have been curious. I mean, this is an old shepherd, right? How did he answer? He didn't just say, I'm 130 years old. You notice what he said. He said, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are few and evil have been the days. The days of the years of my pilgrimage. How did Jacob see himself? As a pilgrim. He's a wanderer. He's not coming to Egypt to plant roots, is he? Does he belong in Egypt? No. He's not staying. He's here for a short time. He's a pilgrim. Did he have roots back in Canaan? Well, maybe, not yet. I mean, all his life he's lived in a tent. Okay? All his life he's lived in a tent. That's not changing. And when he comes to Egypt, that's temporary too. Okay? So Joseph then settled them in Goshen, and he provided them bread. Why was this significant that he provided them bread? Because there wasn't bread, right? Very next verse says there's no bread in all the land. And so then, sort of the final story we see here, surviving the famine in Egypt, we see what Joseph did as an administrator. He was not done. I mean, he was not nearly done with his work there. Gathering up a fifth of the grain for 7 years was only the beginning. Now the hard part starts. And the hard part is they run out of food. And they bring their money, and it says he's collected up all the money in Egypt and Canaan, and they're only a year or two in. So then they say, okay, we're out of money. All right, bring your livestock. The livestock will belong to Pharaoh. Well, if they're out of grain and there's no grass growing, livestock are a liability, right? So the people, they're okay with that. Yeah, we'll give you the livestock. That can be your problem. Just give us some food for our little ones, right? And then the livestock's gone. Now, where are the cries of rebellion? That evil Joseph is hoarding all the food. Do you see that here? Let's not say there weren't any. There probably were. But does the Bible record that the people were rebelling against Joseph? No, it doesn't. You don't see anything in Joseph's behavior that causes the people to say that he has some ulterior motive. They trust him. You know, he's looking out for them. But hey, we're out of money and we're out of livestock. So maybe you can buy our bodies and our land. Okay? And one of the things that I think is kind of interesting to notice here, Joseph is not given handouts, is he? This is not welfare. He's not going to put people on welfare for 7 years. That's not what he's about. So they got to pay money. And then they got to pay livestock. And then they got to pay land. But they're paying, okay? It's keeping them productive members of the society. And then he gives the land back, and he gives them the seed, and then go plant. But you get this back, and you get a tax. And I think we talked about this a little bit last time. How much was the tax? No, not a tenth. Not a tenth. A fifth. 20%. 20% tax rate. Okay? And for that, they got their lives. They lived through the famine. And they got their land back. And they got seed to plant. Not a bad deal. Right? So, Joseph gets them through the famine. He establishes the tax. He establishes that all of this money is going into Pharaoh's coffers, not Joseph's. Right? And so, in a lot of ways, he's reinforcing the authority and the power of the ruler in Egypt by everything he's doing. Who establishes rulers? Where do they come from? The Bible tells us that God establishes authorities, right? So whether Pharaoh was good or bad, he was there because God chose for him to be there, right? And Joseph was reinforcing that authority. And then the last thing we see is Jacob's last request. 17 years later, he's 147 years old. And his request is to be buried in Canaan. And he requires an oath of his favorite son, Joseph. He requires an oath. It's not enough for Joseph to just say, yeah, I'll do it if I get around to it. An oath, a very, very serious oath. And so he takes that oath, and then it's all good. All right. How did Jacob answer Pharaoh regarding his age? Well, we talked about that a little bit, didn't we? But let's look at Hebrews chapter 11 again. We were over there just a minute ago. Hebrews chapter 11, starting this time in verse 13. Hebrews 11, starting in verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He's prepared a city for them. Okay, thanks for your comments tonight. On Sunday, we will talk about the 12 sons of Israel.